Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
About the economy, your finances, everybody else's finances, and hopefully leading eventually to some solutions. Right now, I don't think there are too many solutions. I think there's just too many problems, and we don't even really know what the problems are yet. So we have a long way to go in trying to discover the roots of our troubles, and it'll certainly be even longer before the solutions are found. I came across an excellent article by Bill Bonner. Bill Bonner writes for the Daily Reckoning. He's the president and CEO of Agora Financial. And every day he writes in the dailyreckoning.com an introductory article. And on Fridays he writes a complete essay. And I wanted to indicate the essay today that came up. I thought it was very apropos of what's going on in the financial world, although it does have tangential implications. So here we go. It's called The Good War, and it's by Bill Bonner. The Washington Post reports that the war on terror is over. No armistice has been announced. No treaty has been signed. The whole thing is just being dropped quietly like a burnt-out cigarette. Too bad. It was our favorite war. In the few words that follow, we will explain why. First, the background. The history of the world is but the biography of great men, was Thomas Carlyle's contribution to the genre. But here at the Daily Reckoning, we are more of the cometh the hour, cometh the man school of history. When something needs doing, there is always finds down some clown dim enough to do it. Osama bin Laden was that man. Leading America to the point of bankruptcy was what he was up to, he said in a videotape. He even did the math. Every dollar spent by Al-Qaeda in attacking the U.S. has cost Washington $1 million, or £545,000, in economic fallout and military spending, said the report. We, alongside the Mujahideen, bled Russia for 10 years in Afghanistan until it went bankrupt. So we are continuing this policy in bleeding America to the point of bankruptcy. End of quote. How many generations will still tell of bin Laden's triumph? He brought down not just one empire, but two. His band of terrorists leached the Soviets so thoroughly they fainted. It was no coincidence that the Soviets lost Afghanistan in the same year their empire disintegrated. Then he delivered a challenge to the Americas' amour propre. The attack on the World Trade Center incited a death wish. The feds flashed a red alert. Americans cowered in their houses and sealed their windows and doors against biological attack. The 9/11 attackers could have been pursued by the usual gendarmes at negligible cost. Instead, in the general panic, the Bush administration decided to go all out. Thus it was that the greatest stimulus package since World War II began, in haste and in delusion. The federal budget went from its biggest surpluses to its biggest deficits. Interest rates were cut to an emergency rate of 1%. Within 24 months, the bubble in the NASDAQ was replaced by much bigger bubbles. In housing, finance, derivative debt, art, private equity, executive compensation, student loans, and other forms of private debt. In effect, bin Laden suckered the fattest man on earth into having another éclair. The thunder coming from the financial markets for the past 18 months is the noise of his midriff exploding. But we are not writing to complain about Osama bin Laden or the Bush administration's reaction. When it comes to war and adultery, make-believe may be better than the real thing. Certainly, it is safer. In the war on terror, the enemy had no tanks, no aircraft, no ships, no armies, no celebrated strategists, no famous generals, no sophisticated weapons, no military culture, no leather trench coats, no burnished helmets, no battle cries. The problem was, it was hard to find the enemy at all. The Department of Homeland Security conducted 3 billion airport inspections looking for them. We remember getting patted down so thoroughly, we felt we should leave a tip. But how many enemy combatants do you think they nabbed? Not one. There are two possibilities. The first is that the security procedures were so fearsome that terrorists dared not try anything funny. The second is that there weren't really many terrorists at large, at least not in the United States of America. But compare it to World War I or World War II, or even a penny-ante affair like the Spanish-American War. The war on terror mobilized the whole nation in a great national cause, at much expense, much damage to the Constitution, and much inconvenience, but without actually causing much real suffering. Sure, a few hapless Muslims caught in the wrong place at the wrong time were put on the rack, and yes, the cops in London gunned down a Brazilian electrician. Back in the United States, young couples didn't embrace as they had in World War II. That is, as if there would be no tomorrow. Instead, they spent money as if there would be no tomorrow. No doubt the desperate spending contributed to the bankruptcy of the whole system of bubble finance. But compared to the pain of a shooting war, the war on terror was a delight. As far as we know, the Department of Homeland Security suffered not a single casualty. Not even any self-inflicted wounds, no executions for treason, and hardly any reported cases, neither of fleeing in the face of the enemy, nor collaborating, nor sabotage. What a shame to let such a marvelous war end without even a victory parade. Some of the agents should at least get medals for courage under fire, or exceptional valor. Perhaps some special award, such as the special agents who arrested Tamara Jo Freeman. A Black Heart Medal might be appropriate. The woman was on a flight to Denver when her children got into a squabble. She spanked them both, and then Homeland Security agents put the cuffs on her. Charged with committing an act of terrorism, she spent 3 months in jail and lost custody of her children. And there ought to be some medal for the Pentagon flatfoot who put the long arm of American law all the way across the Atlantic and onto the shoulder of Gary McKinnon. Mr. McKinnon, as the Mayor of London informed us on Tuesday, believes in UFOs. And to prove that the US Army is hiding information on extraterrestrials, he hacked into the Pentagon's computer, leaving his email address and a message, "Your security is crap." Rather than thank him for this useful observation, the Defense Department no doubt put out a billion-dollar consulting contract for someone to tell them their security is crap and put out a warrant for Mr. McKinnon's arrest on a terrorism charge. That kind of service above and beyond the call of duty should be recognized. So form up the battalions of veterans, assemble the legions of luggage inspectors and metal detector operators, and all the thousands of investigators worn down by 5 years of following leads to nowhere. Dress them up in bright, clean uniforms and give them their moment of glory. Pin medals on their chests, then have a jolly march down Fifth Avenue. Line the streets. Give them a hearty hurrah as they march by. Throw out the ticker tape. Young girls, fling yourselves at them and get a kiss, and then send them home. Well, the reason I really thought that that was interesting and actually relevant is because I do believe that the frightful abuse of the monetary system is based in the frustration with 9/11. Remember that the lowering of the interest rates began only a few weeks after 9/11. And indeed, after 9/11 itself, that blunderbuss Bush got up out of his chair and told everybody to spend like mad and to be patriotic and buy stocks. Well, I mean, that kind of comment goes without without any degree of analysis, of coherent analysis whatsoever. It's just nonsense. But it did give rise to the idea that the people of the country needed some kind of recompense for what had happened to them, courtesy of the security services that didn't secure anything, allowing four planes to become hijacked and to cause immense destruction. There was, I think, a sense of guilt and a sense that Americans needed a fair shake, and that fair shake led to the bubbles and to where we are today. Indirectly, it was time for a meltdown in terms of cycles, but I think that 9/11 was almost certainly the catalyst that brought this about. All right, ladies and gentlemen, my information very quickly. I am Richard Martin, and this is Richard Martin's wake-up call coming to you from Miami. What do I need to tell you? Our toll-free number, which all of you should be clamoring to use, and few do, but anyway, it's here and ready for you at 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. Please call any time, and then you can be apprised of whatever information I can give you in response to your questions. Okay. If you'd like to send us an email with your questions, you may do that, and the the address is rmartin@latamenv.com. Latam, that's LATAMINV, like Latin American and investments. Lataminv.com. Once more, rmartin@lataminv.com. Finally, my personal direct phone number, if you would like to ask me questions of a financial or economic nature pertaining to your good selves, you may do so in private by calling me on 305-579-2012. Once more, 305-579-2012. Okay. Now, I just want to make a quick comment about where we stand in terms of this really very grim financial and economic meltdown. Again, I say this, I almost feel like saying it as a matter of course on every single wake-up call. Please understand that whatever else you think you know, the federal government is absolutely incapable of stopping this tsunami. The credit or debt bubble is already $50 trillion. And the bubble is now deleveraging at a pace we haven't seen since the Great Depression. The feds can print $800 billion here and there, but it pales in comparison to the deleveraging that's going on right now under our noses, which is already in the trillions. Credit card companies alone will deleverage $2 trillion in credit this year. I mentioned this on last Thursday's program. I talked about credit cards. The feds and the Treasury Department were just bringing a water gun to a gunfight against guys with AK-47s. You know, you can say that most recently they've upgraded to a BB gun, but frankly, there is no question that the feds can prevent what's coming down from happening. Understand that this deleveraging of credit is so big that the velocity of money continues to decrease and not increase, even using M2 or M3 or even the LIBOR interest rate, is completely irrelevant now. And there are a number of reasons for this. One, the banks are hoarding the money. As I said many times, this is absolutely clear. The banks are not allowing this money out into the general circulation. Secondly, the mood of America has changed. There's no question that now most people who have the ability to borrow don't want to. And the ones that need to borrow through desperation are not the type of people the banks will lend to. You know, especially well now there will be close scrutiny by the government if you take the TARP funds. You know, American banks, which as I said months ago, are insolvent, and I had many people up in arms in indignation for me saying that. But you know, the banks are now essentially nationalized anyway. And the government will take all the true equity, as they will be preferred shareholders, and the common shareholders will be left with nothing soon, especially if you hold the TARP financial stocks. If you take TARP funds, the government will dictate dividends and executive bonuses, and this is nationalization, even though, I can assure you, they won't call it that. You know, the government, as I always say, ladies and gentlemen, they should get out of the way. Allow nature to take its course. But we know they won't do that. And so, in consequence, things will get bad and worse for a very long time. In 2002, 2003, they interfered by lowering rates for too long, creating the housing bubble. Now they may well eventually destroy the dollar eventually and bring on severe inflation in 2 to 3 years' time, but not in the immediate future. In fact, not in any kind of future that we can identify. We will be dealing with deflation, as I told you, for all the reasons that I've just cited. Deflation is in our future for the foreseeable future. Okay? Well, we have several emails. I thought I would deal with a couple of them right now. I had an email from Sarita Alitovsky, who wrote to me on the 29th, just after the show, saying, "Dear Richard, as I told you a while ago, my experience of how people think and are facing the present reality is as if they are ostriches. During the holidays at a party, I began to talk to some people who were saying that in 1 year, all was going to be fine. I finally had to reply and began to say that this was not so, and that I had information from Richard Martin's radio show that the trouble would last many years. The people then left me and didn't speak to me for the rest of the evening. At that point, my son whispered to me, 'Mother, you don't have to tell everyone all that you know.' I felt awful to see that there is so much ignorance and that what I had to say was frowned upon. However, because of your information and all that you teach us, your listeners know that it is a folly to be ignorant at this point in time. Thank you for empowering me and all of us that listen to you. Though the information is grim, this is what is so. Fortunately, I followed your advice and I'm most grateful that I've done so. It is indeed an honor to be part of your bi-weekly classes, and I am most grateful for all your email information. Today, the article of Luke Johnson was one which I quickly emailed to my people. Thank you again, Sarita." And then a day later, she writes again saying, "Dear Richard, would like to add something to my comment, which you will read on Monday. I have had to temper my frustration with experts in my own family, those who have not a clue as to what is going on, without getting angry or being right. I, in my own way, do not correct anyone or try to convince them of anything, because that would simply estrange me from my brothers and my sons. Instead, I have come to the conclusion that one can only allow people to believe what they will believe. Just like you cannot force someone to love you, you cannot force others to adopt your same viewpoint. One must ultimately preserve yourself with knowledge and correct action." Well, you said it all there, Sarita. No problem with that at all. I have an email from Ralph Markowitz, who says, "Please answer on the air if you can. Which stocks would you be shorting that are revolving around bonds, and would you still short some home builders?" Well, the only stock, basically, that will really do it for you, I think, in bonds, you can short TLT, but I would buy TBT, which is the double of the inverse of the long-term bond market. And so you could get quite a good bang for your buck on that score, Ralph. Then Ralph continues, "Also, I came across a video, I think, from CNBC somewhere on YouTube, where the guest speaker was stating that there is a huge medical bubble brewing, already brewed and ready to pop. I, being without medical insurance myself, know the cost is extremely prohibitive for me, and more people dropping out every day. I would assume that the cost is going to get higher and higher until it will not be able to support itself, and then it will collapse. Is there any merit to this? What do you think? If you have any suggestions not to invest in any of these potential companies, it would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, Ralph. Ralph, I keep saying, I've said this over and over and over and over again, do not invest in the stock market. It is a very dangerous place to be right now, in medical stocks or any others. And remember that it isn't just because the price of a product goes up that the stock goes up. The stocks do not always follow fundamentals. And this is itself a fundamental truth which you need to know. Stay away from stocks when times are bad. You'll know soon enough when it comes time to buy stocks, because I'll give you an indication and you'll also feel it in your bones. I do think that all kinds of stocks that have gone up in value now that haven't yet fallen will fall. And I think that it is absolutely the case that you want to stay away from all kinds of stocks for, as I said to you, for the foreseeable future. But there will come a time, I assume that there will come a time in my lifetime when stocks will become a good buy. We got from Phyllis, we got an email saying, "Hello, Richard. First, thanks for everything you do for us. You must have talked about gold many times. Unfortunately, I can't always listen. Gary Now said on his Friday program that gold, Canadian dollars, and the euro would be good places for our money to beat the coming hyperinflation. Can you talk about these, please? He thinks the euro will come back faster than our dollar. Does one just buy Canadian dollars at a money exchange?" You can do, Phyllis, if you wish. That is perfectly possible. You can also buy them at a bank. If you don't want to go into detail about gold, the price at which to buy, where to buy, etc., is there a program in your archives that would cover all bases? Actually, no, there isn't, Phyllis. Save you the time to research. I seldom talk about one issue or group of issues as a program. I occasionally do, but I have not done so when it comes to gold. And then finally, Phyllis says, "John Talbot says in Contagion that the old adage was the price of gold should be that of a fine man's suit. Do you really mean a fine man's suit or a man's fine suit, Phyllis? I don't know many fine men out there, and a lot of them don't wear suits at all." Sorry about that, I couldn't resist. Anyway, which he says is now $750. What is your take on this interesting adage? Well, it is absolutely true, Phyllis. You're absolutely right, and I've mentioned this on my show before. The price of an ounce of gold has tended to buy an outfit of businessmen's attire, which, of course, in Roman days would have been a toga and a belt, and perhaps, I guess, a pair of sandals if you were lucky. Yes, that tends to be about right. And what I have said about gold is that even if it falls in value, it might not fall. I mean, even if it falls in price, it might not fall in value versus other commodities and goods and services. In other words, what if the price of gold, from being 900 where it is right now, falls to 450, but buys, instead of one man's suit, two suits? In other words, the price of suits falls faster than gold. That means that even if the price of gold falls, it will buy more at a lower price than it will today. That is more what I see happening, and that's more what I think people have a hard time understanding, that the price, that the value of gold doesn't have to have very much to do with the price of it. And in fact, the value can soar while the price drops. Maybe I'll devote some time to talking about that on another show, because it's been a long time since I discussed this, and I think a lot of listeners are new perhaps since then, but it does definitely bear talking about. Thank you for your interesting and well-received email, Phyllis. Okay. All right. Well, now I thought I would tell you about what I think is going to be the next very serious implosion that nobody's really talking about, namely the pension funds implosion. You know, from January to October 2008, defined benefit funds, those promising a predetermined amount of retirement money to the payee, averaged losses of 26%. That's a 26% loss in just 10 months. And that's according to Northern Trust Investment Risk Analytical Services, making it the worst year on record for corporate and public pension funds. The largest public pension fund in the United States, the California Public Employees Retirement Security System, otherwise known as CalPERS, lost a staggering 20% of its value in just 3 months last year. In May 2008, Vallejo, California became the largest city in the state ever to file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy, thanks largely to unmanageable pension obligations. The situation in San Diego looks worryingly similar, and corporations with defined benefit plans are seeking relief in Washington as part of a bailout season that shows no signs of slowing down. Well, if the stock market continues on down for even a few more months, corporations that oversee union pension funds and state and municipal leaders responsible for public retirement pools may be faced with difficult choices. First on the docket might be postponing of cost of living increases and reducing health care coverage for retirees. Over the longer term, benefits for new employees will have to be shaved, and everyone is likely to see an increase in personal payroll contributions. Corporations will have to resort to more cost-cutting and layoffs of their own just to guarantee the solvency of their pension funds. And things could go from bad to terrible if the managers of those funds do not quickly revise their investment practices. During melting markets, all pension funds come under siege. If you're covered by a defined pension plan, contributions are invested, usually by your employer and usually in the stock market, and the returns are credited to the employee's account. Your retirement savings grow if the market rises or, as is the case now, bleed when it crashes. You carry the risk on your shoulders. The risk shifts to the employer under defined benefit plans in which future outlays are guaranteed. Well, that seems like a great idea for businesses as recently as 2007 when the market was rising and the pension funds of America's 500 largest companies held a surplus of $60 billion. Now they're at a deficit of $200 billion with fund assets dropping like a stone. The Pension Protection Act of 2006 requires that companies keep the accounts fully funded over time, meaning that they have to save enough money to pay all of their retirees should they decide to withdraw their funds. Yet more than 200 of the 500 big company plans are nowhere close to meeting that standard, and those dire numbers are increasing. Companies with defined benefit pensions may soon find themselves choosing between making payroll or pumping money into their pension plans. If companies are forced to make up the shortfall out of their assets, which seems likely, that would send profits tumbling even more, further destabilizing the stock market. And even with a cash infusion, many businesses might still have to freeze or even cut benefits. Both the corporations and the pensioners are victims of a market meltdown whose depth and duration almost no one predicted. Yet the investment performances of their corporate pension funds, while dismal, are holding up better than the returns of many public and union-defined benefit plans. Those funds are facing their own reckoning, but in this case a lot of pain is self-created and exacerbated by politics. There are about $3.5 trillion tied up in the U.S. retirement system, scattered across more than 2,600 public pension funds and federal retirement accounts. Another $1 trillion or so covers union workers at corporate jobs in which the union has key management control of the fund. These public and union-based defined benefit plans cover 27 million people and represent more than 30% of the $15 trillion held in all U.S. retirement accounts. Traditionally, public investments and union-based corporate pension funds were managed according to strict fiduciary principles designed to protect workers and taxpayers. For the most part, they invested in safe government securities such as bonds or U.S. Treasury bills. Professional managers oversaw funds with little political interference. But during the last 30 years, state pension funds began playing the market, putting their money into riskier and riskier securities. First stocks, corporate bonds, and foreign investments, then real estate, private equity firms, and hedge funds. Well, as I told you, CalPERS finally repealed the screening policy. They recommended a recommendation from their financial advisor, Wilshire Associates, to invest in the equity markets of the four Asian nations. So what stocks did they buy instead? Well, high on the list were financial stocks, which have been given a green bill of health by social investors. CalSTRS recently acknowledged that it had lost hundreds of millions of dollars on Lehman Brothers, AIG, and other fallen icons that were recent favorites of social investors. But those losses pale when the tab comes due for misplaced bets on the boom-to-bust California real estate market. According to a report released last April, CalPERS had 25% of its $20 billion real estate assets in the California market, which has declined faster than the real estate markets in most of the rest of the country. In the summer of 2007, CalPERS was more than 100% funded. It is now under 70% funded and falling, and that doesn't fully factor in its plummeting real estate investments. Funding levels stand near a dismal 50% for Connecticut, where State Treasurer Denise Napier has been a vocal proponent of social investing. Both states are far below mandated minimum funding standards, and they pale in comparison to even the beleaguered ratios of corporate-defined contribution plans, which have mostly avoided using social screens. Large public pension funds have a selfish notion of risk. Heads they win, tails you lose. If they gamble on risky investments that pay off, they are heroes, although the predetermined benefits don't increase. But if those investments go south, tax dollars will have to bridge the gap. This is adding insult to injury, says John Kupel of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Quote, at the same time we're seeing our own 401ks get hit, we're on the hook to make up the shortfalls for public employees who are guaranteed their full pensions without any risk. End of quote. When public funds slide in value, taxpayers get hit from all sides. Their municipalities and school districts that hire firefighters, police, teachers, and other workers have to cut their staff to recapitalize funds. Last October, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors learned that the county would have to come up with an extra $500 million to keep its pension fund whole. That means the county may have to raise local taxes and cut services to deliver on over-extravagant promises it failed to safeguard. There you go. Troubles mounting, ladies and gentlemen, and I fear civil unrest is gathering steam. It is clearly a function of the anger and frustration that people feel, and I think it will bust out in short order. All right, let's have a look at some emails that came in just a few minutes ago. Donna writes in saying, hi, Richard, I followed your advice last year, thank God and thank you, and transferred my funds to the Vanguard Treasury Money Market Fund. Last week I received the attached email and would like to hear your take on it, please. Thanks for your wonderful show and advice, which has saved me, and I'm sure countless others, a huge chunk of retirement funds. Be well, Donna. P.S. I don't know if you care to or have already shared this info on the show, as I'm not able to hear them all, but I've been curious as to why you've chosen Singapore to be your new home. All the best to you and your wife in that move. Well, I won't read out the full email. Some of you will already know it. I've had some impassioned emails on this subject. But basically, Vanguard have closed their treasury bill fund to new investors, because, quite frankly, they've got enough on their plate, and I don't think they want to be involved with any more of this stuff. It doesn't have very high returns for them. Treasury bills not yielding almost anything in the first place. And I don't think they want to be involved, quite frankly. So that's really the answer to your question, Donna. Why we've chosen Singapore, I've mentioned several times. I'll do another program on it one of these days. It's a small city-state. Very few people. It has an excellent government. It's the most popular government on earth, according to a poll that was done a few weeks ago. It is a calm place. It will ride out the depression, I think, better than almost anywhere else, certainly in Asia. And, of course, Asia is the powerhouse of the future. That's it in a nutshell, Donna. We will, as I say, talk about this in more detail further down the line. Your fan, Anthony Johnson, hello, Anthony, wrote in an email saying, Richard, can you name the article that you read today? The article I read today comes from The Daily Reckoning of last week. I've already been asked by Ryan, our engineer, for a copy of the article. You can find it, actually, by going, and I'll do it, and Ryan, I will get you the copy, don't worry. But for the rest of you, you will find it by going to thedailyreckoning.com and searching the archives. And I think that it was last Friday's report, but I don't have the certainty about that. But I, as I say, I think it was from last Friday. And the article was entitled The Good War. So you might find it in the archives under The Good War. But it's within the last 10 days, for sure. Okay, that's Anthony's email. Right, let's take Steve's rant, which was conceived in the doldrums of yesterday afternoon, and it is as follows. Steve says, Richard, Thursday's show is outstanding. Frank really does have a good handle on our financial problems and, as always, has a lot to contribute. Richard, I will give you some of my thoughts on why this time, quote, it really is different from 1929. I feel it has the potential to turn into a doomsday depression. The first thing that will intensify the depression is that we enter this time with money that is not backed by gold. We are at the mercy of our trading partners. They will not continue to buy our debt and exchange their goods for dollars. In 2009, we're not trading with the Manhattan Indians. We're trading with the savvy nations, and if and when they wake up to the fact not only is the emperor naked, but that most of the population are down there to their shorts, they will stop purchasing our debt and no longer trade in dollars. In 1929, we were a nation of 140 million people. If you say half were women, and women were not very prevalent in the workforce yet, so you could say we had a workforce of 50 million, with 25% unemployed, 12 million were out of work. Today we have a population of 325 million, and we have over 12 million out of work now. Third is the public education system at its lowest point of mediocrity ever. In 1947, public schools were relieved by law of assuming the role of the child's parents during school hours. This left the child and teacher to go their separate ways. Teachers could no longer discipline the child. Then enters PC with its madness. We can't hurt the child's feelings. We can't let the child compete, because when you compete, someone else will lose, and we can't have that. This feel-good system allows the child's first major defeat to arise as an adult. An example of what this can lead to is the recent California couple who both lost their jobs, and the father goes home and murders his entire family. Richard, in 1929, people got through it. We had charities, access to food, and even if you didn't have much money or a job, you could day-to-day it and get by. This is not what I see this time around. This go-around, I see the world no longer buying our debt. This will cause our interest rates to soar, starting a chain of events that will bring us to a point of critical mass. Food will sell out in supermarkets, then the stores will be looted. It will get so bad we will not have access to food. Your safety will depend on your neighborhood. Too crowded is bad, too isolated is just as bad. What we did was to move to an island in South New Jersey, accessible via a bridge, two lanes in, two lanes out. Even with a reduced police force, it would be easy to close the island to outsiders. I do see a lot of people starving and getting killed over food. Richard, we have so many unknowns in this. Your analogy of the junkie is by far the best ever. All our leaders are acting like addicts, and they will not acknowledge their addiction until they hit bottom. The sad thing is we will hit bottom before they will. If the Fed has the intent of printing money to cover all of the bad debt, that could be $150 trillion. That is not a doubling of the money supply. It would be the upping of the money supply by 400. With the cost of living increases, our Social Security check could come in around $60,000 a month. Richard, I see this winding up with soldiers in the streets, and make no mistake, they will shoot fellow Americans. It is the government that feeds and protects the soldiers and their families. At this point, I see the opportunity for the appearance of a benevolent dictator, ha-ha, and that will spend the end of we the people. Richard, it seems I have outranted myself on this one. If this is too long-winded for the air, it will not hurt my feelings. Thanks for the wake-up call, Steve Kruger. Well, Steve, the best way to get information, I believe, on this, as I see it, quite frankly, is to wait for it to happen. I mean, you know, there is no panacea socially for this kind of thing. What's going to happen is going to happen. There is absolutely no way in which this whole thing can be just taken and thrown aside, and everybody will get happy, and that will be the end of it. It isn't going to happen. The only way in which this particular problem can possibly be alleviated is by allowing it to degenerate in its own way to rock bottom. And that's what will have to happen. The social services will have to deal with the casualties, but they cannot deal with the symptoms. Okay, well, here we have now an email from Bob Barkey, which I am going to read to you because it allows me to talk a little bit more about life insurance. And I did have somebody a while back who came to me in a rather desperate way trying to get my opinion on what I thought about annuities. And I expressed the feeling that because of the tremendous penalties involved in liquidating annuities, along with the tax implications, it is an extraordinarily great onus on me to come up and say to you, well, I think you should do this because the consequences are really quite dire. But anyway, I got an email from Bob Barkey. I thought I would talk a little more about this, saying, Richard, thanks for all the financial information you provide. I am considering purchasing long-term care insurance and was wondering, with all the financial turmoil, do you think there will be any problems with insurance companies that offer long-term care policies which might not be used for another 15 or 20 years out? Do you have any thoughts on whether these companies will be able to honor their coverage contracts when all the baby boomers need help without drastically raising rates, which many current subscribers could not afford and would have to drop coverage and lose what investment they have already made? Perhaps they won't even survive this current crisis. Thanks for your valuable opinion. Well, you know, it's hard to know how to deal with this. You know, any of you have had a life insurance policy, you probably were very, very alarmed if you heard the industry lobby arguing that some insurers are in such dire shape that they need immediate relief from requirements meant to keep them solvent. Well, the regulators then came in and denied the relief, and the industry lobby was very quick to issue a more soothing message. Don't worry, there is plenty of money to pay claims. Well, these very mixed messages may have left you hoping you never need life insurance, but if you already do have a policy or need one to protect spouse and children, how nervous should you be? And the problem is that it's really hard to know. And I did mention this, I think, before, but it's worth saying again. There is a safety net that could protect you if your insurer fails. The trouble with that, though, is that there are limits to the benefit it covers, and the safety net itself has vulnerabilities all of its own. You know, if you do dump your policy, remember that itself could have serious consequences. You know, depending on your age and health, you might have trouble replacing it, or obviously end up paying much more for a new policy. And that, of course, carries a whole different separate set of risks. You see, when you buy life insurance or an annuity guaranteed by an insurance company, you're counting on the insurer to keep its commitment years or decades from now. The insurance industry's wherewithal is closely tied to the health of the broader financial system. If the investments that insurance companies make with your premium dollars don't perform well enough over the long run, or even the not-so-long run, insurers could have trouble keeping their promises. I mean, obviously, if that happens, we're going to have a lot of other bigger financial problems to worry about. But the president of the American Council of Life Insurers, Frank Keating, who, by the way, was also the former Oklahoma governor, conveyed a sense of the uncertainty in a statement after state regulators handed his group a resounding defeat. And I quote, "To date, the industry's capital and reserve levels have weathered the financial turmoil currently gripping our nation, and life insurers remained well-positioned to meet their obligations to policyholders. However, no one knows when this current market turmoil will end or what effect it will ultimately have on our economy." Okay, well, so now we have to ask ourselves, I mean, how is the health of the insurance industry? Well, according to firms that specialize in rating companies' credit, they would tell you probably generally strong and generally deteriorating. And, of course, life insurers are feeling the market's pain along with everybody else. They are not excluded from this. Some of them, of course, are squeezed because they promised to deliver at least minimum annuity payments. But those guarantees are no longer supported by the investments underlying them, which is very alarming. Shrinking assets, as you know, can lead to credit downgrades, higher borrowing costs, loss of business. You know, companies to meet obligations can be forced to sell assets at a loss. Meanwhile, to stay in compliance with regulatory standards, they can be forced to shore up their capital by raising money from investors on extremely unfavorable terms. You know, insurers invest in assets as varied as corporate bonds and commercial mortgages, and if the recession leads to increasing defaults, they stand to lose. So, as I said, you know, canceling your policy or annuity might trigger a surrender charge. Now, if the policy has cash value, as I'm sure all of you know, you can ask your insurer for the cash. But that will cost you too. If the amount is greater than the amount you paid in premiums, you could then experience a taxable gain and have to pay income tax on the gain that was reported for that policy. And then if you cash out an annuity, you could end up with a 10% early penalty withdrawal if you're under 59. And then, of course, if you get rid of a life insurance policy and subsequently denied you want one, you could have a hard time getting one or end up paying substantially more. You know, policies are based on age and health. Now, one thing that you can do if you have a policy, you could try to sell it. There are companies that purchase life insurance policies in the secondary market. You might actually be able to get more selling it rather than taking the cash value. But whatever you do, make sure that you shop around. Not just for the best price. You want an affordable policy, sure, but you also want to make sure you're getting it from a sound company. So how do you know about your insurance provider's company? Well, you can go to the rating agencies, AM Best, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, Fitch. They've all sized them up, but keep in mind that rating agencies don't always get it right. Some, as you know, have come under fire for giving investors a false sense of confidence in mortgage-related securities, which have helped cause the financial meltdown. The problem with individual rating agencies, you see, is that they all have a different nomenclature, which is, by the way, on purpose. It's like when you go to buy a car and you want to compare different dealerships' prices, they all give you different combinations of extras and one thing and another, making it absolutely impossible for you to compare apples to apples. This is done on purpose. One thing that you can do, ladies and gentlemen, you can go and seek advice from a professional, such as a certified financial planner or an insurance agent or broker. But remember that these sales professionals, even if they can help you sort it all out, they do still earn commissions from selling policies. So your advice may be tainted, it may be biased, and they will, of course, receive a cut of your premiums as long as the policy is in force. You know, and I assure you, shopping for a life insurance policy is a lot more complicated than shopping for a new car. Not only do you have to research the company, you must also weigh the different types of policies available. For example, whether to get whole life or term life. Term, of course, being cheaper, but also temporary. And then when it expires, there's no money back. On the other hand, whole life is permanent, but more expensive. It's a form of forced savings. Your money essentially goes into a tax-deferred account. Now, do remember that life insurers are not federally chartered, like the FDIC. So whereas the FDIC backstops your bank accounts, the safety net for life insurers consists of other life insurers. If one company fails, its competitors are called upon to contribute money to pay its obligations, subject, of course, to certain limits. So the failure of one insurer can actually become a burden on the rest, and a big enough failure or wave of failures could strain both the safety net and the industry as a whole. The safety net itself is made up of industry alliances in each state called guarantee associations. Combined as of 2007, those associations had the ability to raise $4.7 billion annually from member firms. The National Organization of Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Associations, which helps coordinate the system, couldn't give a dollar value for the insurance commitments that the system is responsible for backing. But to give you some perspective, at the end of 2007, not including annuity guarantees, life insurance had $19.5 trillion of coverage in place in the United States, and that was according to the ACLI. But in recent testimony, the chairman of the ACLI, Pat Baird, expressed skepticism about the system's ability to do its job smoothly. The individual benefits guaranteed by the associations vary from state to state. The guarantees in most states are $300,000 in death benefits, $100,000 in cash withdrawals from life policies, $100,000 in cash withdrawals from annuities, and $300,000 total per person. And that's according to NOLHGA. Well, one way to hedge your bets is to buy multiple smaller policies from different insurers rather than one big policy. Just make sure that each policy doesn't exceed the maximum amount that your state guarantee association covers. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that you are probably over time going to end up paying a larger premium. But several industry advocates say that consumers need not worry so much. And I quote Weatherford again, "This is a highly regulated, highly monitored industry with an outstanding track record of delivery." Now, the ACLI's Keating noted in an interview that some life insurers have been around longer than your grandparents. Well, that's a little comfort to Michael Zabko, who recently renewed his 14-year term in life insurance policy. The 55-year-old Mechanicsville resident who manages the Red Cross office in Southern Maryland had a policy with one insurer, but wanted to see if he could get a cheaper one with a more highly rated company. In the end, he stayed put, but said that he's not convinced that his insurer or any other company will be solvent years from now. I quote, said, "In today's economy, there are no guarantees. You just have to make the best decision and the best guess," he said. So, where do I stand in all that? Well, I tell you, I feel that you should not take out any new policies. I find that it would be quite pointless to do that. But what you can do is, in my opinion, work with the policies that you already have and make sure that they belong to very solvent insurance companies as much as you can. But of course, remember that you have to be quick to move because you don't get much notice. AIG was not given any forewarning before it collapsed. So nothing is sure in this world, and nothing has ever been truer than that, I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen. All right, well, now, Roman Bistrianic just very kindly emailed me with a link to the article I read you at the beginning from the Daily Reckoning, which is www.dailyreckoning.com/the-good-war. Once again, for those of you who want to write down the link to the article I read you earlier today at the beginning, www.dailyreckoning.com/the-good-war. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back at the end of a show again, and I look forward, as always, to talking to you again on Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call saying bye-bye till then.